It does it's seem great. So unforced yeah. and natural on screen.
But some people use that sort of tension as their engine. I mean, that's a real subtle acting technique. Is you wake up, everything's great, you're in Africa, it's 75 degrees, take a dip in the pool, you know, and you go up to work and you're feeling great. But you have to be somehow troubled in a scene, so you work up a little contretemps on the set, and then you get into it. You got your anger already there. A lot of actors do that.
Do you
do that?
Yeah, I've done it occasionally. Because sometimes you just don't feel like being mad.
Yeah.
Is Redford hard to work with? I mean, he seems like he's a distant person, and he often comes across that way. Is that true? Or?
Well, he's a very strange combination of distant and intimate. I think it's the function of the position that he's in. It's sort of this icon. Some reason in the movie business that I would imagine for him it would be very hard to talk to anybody with any amount of trust. So immediately in any situation you put up a barrier because you don't know where what you're saying is going to appear or around whose dinner table it will be repeated or, you know, and I've even noticed that myself just being much more cautious than I ever used to be.
You know,
and I think he's that way. I think it's caution more than just aloofness anyway. That's really my perception. And as we got to know each other, I just really liked him so much and thought he was quite forthcoming. But I know why he has that.
Well, when someone does have that reserve, does it make it hard to play?
No, he doesn't really have that. What I'm saying is he doesn't really have that reserve.
Oh, I see.
As a part of his being. It's a
it's more like a
protection before he gets to know everything's safe. And plus, when he's playing, I mean, when he's in the scene, he's very available. In fact, he's unusually receptive for a man. I mean, he's a very good listener, which is an unusual quality in men. I found.
What do you guys say?
Well, no, I mean, men are aggressive listeners. They're listening and they're formulating as they listen. Mm-hmm. And they're making up their ideas as they go along. Really,
here we are leaning forward.
This is our job.
Well, no, that's your job, yes. But, you know, I figured this out when I went to, first I went to a women's college, then I went to a men's college. And it was a difference in sort of aggressive and receptive listening on the part of men and women. Anyway, Redford has a quality that I think is probably was one of the things that I know Sidney knew about him vis-a-vis this character, Finch Hatton, because I think that that guy really did draw Isaac, the storyteller, out of Isaac Dinesen, of Karen Blixen. I really think that that was a lot of his function in her life.
Well,
that she was the raconteur, and he made it easy for her to put it out there.
And we are permitted that scene where you do tell the story at the beginning.
Yeah, but I mean, Redford is unusual. I really can't emphasize that enough about him. He made me, as a woman, feel completely comfortable in every way. I mean, I felt that I trusted him, that what I was saying was going no further than him, and so I think that gave him the same trust in me.
Give a couple moments.
At the very beginning, the voiceover is spoken in a very slow, lilting kind of cadence, which sets the tone.
He's also great. Mm-hmm. Great kisser.
That's what we really wanted. About. Thanks.
We didn't dare.
Let's get to the kissing.
But I was just wondering whether that was your idea or Sydney's, or was that the idea to sort of set the cadence for the entire film that way, that sort of lilting, slow?
Well, we didn't design it that way. I was very afraid of that because I thought, mean, that is the way she spoke. Mm-hmm. But I said, let's use some artistic license here because it's going to, you know, I can't do it anymore. It's going to get so slow, you know. And, but that is the way she spoke. And he, I must say, he just always had faith that the story would tell itself and would be told a lot at its own measure, you know, at its own pace. And it's sort of the way the book is. It's true to the book, and that's the hardest thing in the world to do in a movie, is capture what it is that makes the book special. And that has to do with her voice in the storytelling. It is measured, it is economical, and it is, you know,
well, you,
quiet.
You literally are telling stories. There's some recordings out now, of course, Velveteen Rabbit and things like
that. Oh, yeah.
Is it something you've always enjoyed doing, this sort of thing?
No.
Is that a relatively new...
Since I've had children.
Because
I'm intimately acquainted with every single, you know...
Is it difficult or is it frustrating when, and I'll use a specific example here, I thought in general critics were very unfair to Plenty and didn't understand the character at all and what her problems were. Does that bother you after you've spent that much time on a film, this, you know, an important film that comes out and everybody sort of dumps it?
How sensitive of you. Yes, it does. It does, absolutely. It just, there's nothing more blindingly hurtful than the 2 minutes they give you on TV for something that you really sweat blood over for, you know, 4 months or so. And, but it's sort of the way things are now. I mean, what are you going to do? Things are chewed up and thrown away.
Do you think maybe you get a little unfair over criticism just because you've been outstanding in so many films and you're so consistent? So do you think maybe people...
They look hard at me, I know that. They look real hard at me. But that's all right, I mean...
Okay, but to be looked at hard and to be listened to hard, that could be a paralyzing thing if you begin to let it worry you too much, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. That's one advantage of not allowing any time between jobs, because then you begin to worry. And when I just keep working, then I have a place to put all my anxiety. I put it all into the work. And I got so much to do and so much to think about, just arranging my life and putting together a character, that I don't have time to worry about what they're saying. And, but I must say, it doesn't get easier. And each year, you know, the criticism is sort of more... I think you're tougher when you're younger.
Interesting.
Didn't used to bother me so much, and now my husband says, "Relax, you know, it's just Pauline Kael, she's sick." So I can't help it. It just keeps me awake.
But at the same time, you've got a job, if you want to call it that. It takes you all over the world.
Absolutely.
Exposed you to different cultures, literally.
Don't ever think I'm not counting my lucky stars. Never forget that. No, this is a ridiculously fortunate position that I'm in at all.
Pardon this question away, but if you've seen the TV ads for this film.
I haven't. What is it?
Well,
what is it? How does it go? I can't wait.
Perhaps I'm just a Meryl Streep fan, but it seems like it's sort of, and also with Meryl Streep.
Oh.
You know, it's Redford, and it's very, especially after you've seen the film, you know, it's
oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, like we said in the other room, he looks great in khaki, and I think they've sort of zeroed in on that.
Well, great.
I just wondered if that would be
annoying. I must say, I thought I'd get first billing on this one, but it hasn't happened, so... I think, you know, it has to do with economics, and they're smart, you know, the people that market these movies. They know what will bring people in. They're not dummies. And, you know, I think that's... I'm anxious to have people come and see it, too, so whatever they want to do, that'll get them in. That's okay with me.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
French columns. This must have been quite different.
Yes, very. I enjoyed it. It was a very exciting, especially when you met special people. They didn't saw me as the people from Hollywood. It was very natural, very simple. And that made me comfortable to work with Sydney. Robin was excellent. We had a good relationship with Robert, and Meryl special was very helpful. So I didn't saw really people from Hollywood with all those big things. It was very natural with people there, not only me, but with the local people. We always comfortable. I'm sorry for my English because I speak better French.
It's fine.
We must care about something because we say often action or something like that, and that was a pure life at that time. Mm-hmm. Because people from Europe, they was gentlemen, they go to Africa pour le romantisme, pour aventure, et c'est la réalité. That was the realities. So it is not for me kind of a romantical thing with nothing. That exists until now. The Europeans who live there, they got that adventure dream. So it wasn't realistic or something like that. If it was realistic, I would not get able to play that character of Farah.
Mm-hmm. So you think the Europeans and Americans have romanticized that
no.
Time?
You mean if American... can you repeat again?
Do you think that
c'est pas, it's not romanticized. Because what I was saying is that at that time in 1914, European gentlemen, British gentlemen who go there, or American who go there, wasn't kind of romanticized. And the film, I haven't seen it yet, but what I saw from filming. And the whole thing with the dignity, with the respect, with the local people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I myself, from Mandingo tribe and half Tuareg, if something with, because I know what people are expecting for, if I saw something wrong, I would be very embarrassed. And what was great, all those people respect the people on set, and then there wasn't any kind of, you know, romanticism or naked African, you know. Because I can make it take off my clothes to you with dignity. But if I do it just to say I'm taking my clothes to something not there. And for the film I haven't seen, because you're talking about American people, for example. Who was there, you mean? Who was in Africa at that time, you mean? No. There wasn't any romantic or something. It was a really honest work. With Sydney was very sage, respect, and then Meryl was like that, then Robert too. How I can say it was romantic just to make a Hollywood and then no?
Well, it can be romantic without being false.
Yes, that's what I mean, because romantic got many faces. I mean, il y a beaucoup de faces dans le romantisme, parce que le romantisme peut être quelque chose de de faire plaisir. The romantism can be positive or negative sometimes. It depends what you mean romantic, you know.
Sounds much better in French. It's
everything sounds better.
Everything sounds better in French.
Parce que, excusez-moi de parler un peu en français, c'est que dans le film, ce qu'il y avait comme vérité, c'était une vérité de l'époque. Et les gens qui allaient en Afrique en 1914, c'était quelque part où on y allait pour exploiter, où on y allait aussi parce que on pouvait aller en Afrique faire du cheval et faire la chasse. Ça aussi, c'est un très beau romantisme, je veux dire. Allez.
Now, do you translate that for us?
something about the spirit of the age. No.
Does anyone here speak French?
No. How did you get into films? How did you get into movies?
Well, I'm from Mali, and we got a kind of theater calling Koteba. Koteba, it is a theater that European compare to Commedia dell'arte, some Orientals compare to Kabuki or theater, no theater. And then I start from this theater until I met Grotowski. I don't know if you heard about Grotowski.
Oh, yes.
Great Polish director.
Where did you meet him?
You know, my country was independent in 1960. At that time, we cut with the European, I mean, Western country, you know, kind of democratic things. Sometimes Eastern country give a scholarship to people to come to study in Poland or Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia, or, you know. And then Grotowski was at that time in Varsovie, and I got a scholarship to come and work with him. And then after that, I met Peter Brook from 1970.
Keeping some pretty heavy company there.
Yeah, and then we worked together for 15 years with Peter Brook. We went to Prussia. We traveled all Africa, playing the village with the African. And we went to South America, and then we came many times in America to play with the Teatro El Campesino from California, Luis Valdez. And we went to Houston. We played in Houston. Hmm. Yeah. and Minneapolis in the reservation with the Indian people. many different places, even in the prison in America, and hospital psychiatric, how you call it?
Say it again?
Psychiatric, hospital, psychiatric.
Oh, psychiatric?
Psychiatric hospital in America, hospital. We, you know, we...
Psychology.
Well, and we put on a play calling The Ick from Colin Turnbull. Colin Turnbull... that was translated by Colin Higgins. Mm-hmm. I worked with Colin Higgins and with Joe Chekin too.
So you've been in it a long time.
In the theater.
Well, I'm curious too, growing up, you're mentioning theatrical experiences. Is there a filmmaking industry in Mali? What about Africa generally?
Quite interesting question. We got a film industry in Africa, but economical condition, for example...
I've seen an African film called Black Girl. It's the only one I've ever even heard of or that's been released here that I know of.
We had many films in Africa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it is not a big industry. You see, for example, the actors, they can come and ask you, I got a few money, can you do my movie? So you do it with a little money, with nothing. But we got a production there in Africa.
Now, I'm sorry, did I... Where do you live now?
We must be clear about it. Of course, we all say African tradition is get away. This is in the city. You know, if I want to go to the country, for example, you got a city, you got a country, and in the country is very, is still very, very strong. Somehow, they try to break it. I mean, because we must be modern or something like that. But I think African culture is, c'est une culture très forte. It's a very strong culture. You cannot just do that because it is very easy to say yes, they lost their culture or something like that. But it depends, because people are still in the country with a big dignity and a strong... They are not political. They don't know nothing about the politics. Mm-hmm. They don't know nothing about the corruption. If you live in the city, so you know the corruption. Of course, our leaders are, in general, very corrupt, because you came to study in France or somewhere, so you go there. But those people are not interested about politics and something. So they block the condition, I mean, people who come to study or something like that, you see. But I think, especially in my country, we're still playing our koteba. Koteba, this
theater. Theater.
We still play it. We still play it, our drum, dance, all those things is there. So, of course, some people, maybe like me too, I don't know, try to bring another thing, but it's very difficult.
Because a country like Australia seems to be rediscovering the Aboriginal cultures, certainly in its films. And I'm wondering if in Africa there is a new sense of the roots there, of the tribal culture.
Yes, the whole film that we made now in Africa, it's about the true situation. Like God Must Be Crazy, not that kind of film, but that's a very good film. I like it, but I was enjoying it. But we, African director, that's the reason they cannot sell their film, because it is, they got a conscience to make a true African film with mm-hmm. the African dialect or languages, you know. So they cannot sell it. I mean, for example, if I tell you the film that I have done, it's very popular in Mali or in whole West Africa, in Nigeria, and they all go to see Malik Bawans is in this movie. It's typical African movies. But sometime in experimental little theater in Paris, you can see them. But it's very popular in Africa.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm wondering if...
I was right. I mean, I saw that you were on one of these...
Well, I started in the business as a reporter, but at the point at which I left it, I was executive editor of the paper in Detroit. So I had worked through...
I meant you were on the news side, yeah.
Yeah, yes, right.
What drew you to this book? It seems like it'd be very hard to adapt a screenplay for...
I fell in love with Karen Blixen when I was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. She, for me, always had just been the most romantic woman who ever actually lived. Mm-hmm. So it was easy to write in that sense, because I was just so enamored of her.
Was it also a question of falling in love with the prose, which can be a danger, to fall in love with the material that you're adapting, because then you're not maybe ruthless enough with it, you know?
Obviously I admire her prose, but it was really the woman and my mental pictures that I was in love with. And I mean, I just wouldn't try, and if I sat there and tried to match or top Isaac Dinesen, you know, you could really wind up in a very bad place. So I didn't try and do that.
I remember when I read it, I marked that famous passage that you used near the end of the film, "Will Africa Have a Dream of
Song
Me?"
Song of Africa, yeah.
Did that also trigger in you an instant response, like, this must have a place in the script someplace?
Yes, but I mean, what I most wanted was the letter that she had gotten. That's now the kind of the epilogue of the film, about the friend who writes about lions, seen the Maasai have reported to the district commissioner in Ngong that they have seen lions on Fitchatten's grave. That was absolutely going to be in the script no matter what I had to do. Song of Africa, maybe if we can figure out a way to do it. I worried that it was purple and that it could get, if we didn't shoot it right, that it could get too purple. And I think for some people it probably is too purple, but it works well enough.
Everyone's talked about how the difficulty would be in this project is getting a narrative line, getting a story to tell. How did the story present itself to you, or how did you put together this story?
I feel like I didn't put together the story. I mean, this woman led this life, and I wrote about a life that was led. Karen did the story by living it.
When did you read the biography? Was that something that you had read a long time ago as well, or not?
No, the biography was just published 2 years ago.
Yeah. So did you read it in anticipation of writing the screenplay? Is that what?
No, we had already. It was interesting. We had a new book had become available. Silence Will Speak. And that's what we planned to use to make the picture. And we found out after I was already into the project, by accident, I was in Venice and ran into, through a mutual friend, was introduced to Judith Thurman. And they said, you know, you ought to meet Judith Thurman. She's writing a biography of Karen Blixen. So I thought, ooh, I mean, look out. If television gets their hands on Judith's biography, we could wind up in a competitive, you know, situation. We better, yeah. So we bought Judith's book unread. Nobody read it. It was just get it off the market so that we don't have to worry about it. And none of us knew that what we were buying was turned out to be a National Book Award winner, the best literary biography of the last 10 years. We just got dumb lucky.
Also, I'm curious how you considered dealing with the syphilis business. At any time, did you consider leaving it out entirely, developing it more than it was developed? What were your crucial decisions there?
I never questioned the fact that we were going to use it. There was a time in the 60s, it was a condition of the Rungstedlin Foundation, which is Karen Blixen's literary executor, when they had sold the film rights to Hollywood then, there was a contractual stipulation that said, well, I think it even gave him script approval, but it said specifically, and you cannot mention the syphilis. So when we rebought the rights on this time around, that was a process that I was involved in, and we told the foundation, no script approval, and we'll tell you before you sell us the material, we definitely are going to acknowledge the syphilis, and if you don't want that done, don't sell us the stuff. So that would always was intended to be part of the picture because it was part of her life.
But yet at the same time, you chose to see it as being cured.
Well, cured in the sense that Karen was cured.
Yeah, that at least I got the sense in the film that it had been arrested. It was not going to, no further deterioration.
Yeah, and that's what happened.
Deterioration.
Yeah, that's what happened. She was sort of ill for the rest of her life, but that was as a result of the treatment. And the treatment for syphilis in those days was arsenic and mercury, toxins. Apparently what they did was stimulate the immunological system of the body to create antibodies. So it really was a situation where the cure could kill people.
Yeah.
It didn't kill her, but she suffered the ravages for the rest of her life.
You mentioned the stipulations of the Rungstedlin Foundation. It would also have been a stipulation of the Hollywood establishment less than 15 years ago not to have brought up that
I
topic
suppose.
Either, right?
I suppose, yeah.
I'm curious, as a writer, if you enjoy the fact that you've got a greater latitude and freedom in dealing with this than you might have had 15 years ago.
I guess. I mean, but again, I don't think that way. I don't think, gee, it's terrific that it's 1985, so I don't have to deal with the problems of 1960. I mean, I just think it's 1985.
Why did you reduce the time span in the film from, was it 19 years or 17 years? I saw it written both ways. In the,
her time in Africa?
Her time in Africa.
Her time in Africa is 17.
And although I really wasn't aware of it when I was watching the film, I mean, if they'd gotten through and said it was 17 years, I wouldn't have known any difference. But it does say that it was actually supposed to be just 10 years.
The script is not specific on the point, but our sense of the script is that it plays about 8 years. Well, I mean, we didn't have 17 years worth of story. Why go through the problems of aging the actors just to say it was 17 years when you don't have 17 years worth of story? We could have done more time passage stuff and shot a couple of more montages or, you know, done whatever. But why do it?
How much of the script was sort of reworked in process?
For 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks of shooting. And then Sidney would call often as they were going forward with the script. He'd call and say, you know, next Saturday we're going to shoot scene 72. Take a look at that. I don't quite like the way, you know, he's doing this and she's doing that. So we would do stuff like that on the phone.
Would some things have to be adapted to fit, you know, just the physical requirements of where they were shooting, or you know, something, weren't able to get exactly what you wanted?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, not very much. The only thing like that I can think of, there was a scene in which Brohr asked Karen for a divorce. That was originally written to be taking place on a polo field with a polo match going on. They had rain where that black cotton soil in Kenya just turns to soup. So they had to say, we haven't got a polo field here we can use that's rideable. But they did find a smaller enclosure that they could dry out, so it became Felicity, you know, jumping her horse over whatever. Stuff like that. But I don't think of that as all that significant.
Was it your idea all along to concentrate on the romance with the Finch Hatton?
Well, what I wanted to do was write about Karen and her life. She was what interested me. Now, the fact of Dennis, of course, is a part of that. But what I was trying to do was write Karen.
There was the other character there that is Dennis's friend. I forget his name.
Barclay Cole.
Barclay.
There seems to be, at first, they were just real good friends.
Well, he was kind of in love with her. I mean, at distance, Barclay was.
She certainly seems to be more interested in him at first than she is with Dennis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, he's been such an adventurer, if I recall. He's fascinating to her.
Dennis?
He's done everything. Barclay.
No.
He's a very kind of romantic figure himself, actually.
Romantic in the sense that, you know, I mean, anybody who at that time had come out from England to live in the edge of the world, I guess, was romantic in some sort of way. But Barclay wasn't all that much. He wasn't the adventurer that Finch Hatton was.
You mentioned rain a while ago. Was a lot of the film shot in the non-rainy season? Because there is not a lot of rain. Literally in the picture.
Well, they started shooting in early January, so January, February, and most of March are dry, and the rains come usually right around the 1st of April. So, I think the rains, ask Sydney, but I mean, I think the rains were a little bit late.
Because it must be really strange to work in a country that has such a pronounced climatological change like that, and to try and convey all that, even if you're there primarily at a time when it's dry.
Yeah. Yeah, although we knew, you know, we had the advantage of African weather is strange, but it's also more structured in terms of predictability. You don't know exactly when the rains are going to come, but you do know January and February are probably going to be very dry, and when the rains start, that they'll be with you for a while, so you can plan for it.
Why film? Why screenwriting?
As opposed to?
Well, writing novels. What else do newspapermen graduate to, I guess? I don't know. I'm just sort of intrigued about, were you a film aficionado?
No.
Before?
before?
No, I mean, I've spent large parts of my life trying desperately to avoid failure. And I would not, there's just no possibility that I would write a novel of the quality of the novels that I admire. So I would be saying sort of cheerfully, well, apparently I'm going to fail at this, but I'll do it anyway. I'm not emotionally capable of doing something like that. With film, the degree of collaboration is so high that I can do a piece of work that when the professionals get their hands on it, when you get a production designer like Stephen Grimes and a photographer like David Watkin and an actress like Meryl Streep, I don't have to be as good as I would have to be standing alone as a novelist. I can write a dumb line for Meryl Streep and she can make it work. So
that's a remarkable answer. Thank you for that. That's wonderful.
You're giving yourself enough credit.
But nonetheless, any artist has to know limitations. That's part of being an artist. So I don't think you're not minimizing anything at all there, I don't think.
Well,
what's the situation with Schindler's List?
God, I wish I knew. I'm writing a script.
I was talking to Steven Spielberg last week, and he said he was anxiously looking toward getting it very soon.
Yeah, that's been his position since August. Yeah,
he said that you had an early version that several, 8 or so months ago you just tossed out.
I don't know, and I don't know how he found that out either, because I didn't tell him, and I don't want that known. I mean, I wish that I'm, you know, reading the paper saying, "How the hell does he know that?" I only told 3 people. I'm in the process of figuring out which one of them squealed. But it is correct.
Hmm. Are you a temperamental writer, or are you highly self-critical then of your stuff? Okay.
Very.
The bio makes it seem like you just suddenly...
I hadn't had it with newspapers. It was that I had gotten the best newspaper job I was going to get quite young. So when I was 38, I'd been executive editor of the Free Press for 5 years and could legitimately look forward to 27 years to retirement. And I just thought, well, that's, I mean, the person doing the same job for 32 years is ridiculous. And then thought, well, if you're going to change careers, don't hang around. I mean, don't go try and do it when you're 50, when nobody will talk to you. Do it now. And went to Hollywood thinking that I had an administrative background. I'd run an operation that is about the size of a studio or about the size of a working film company. As a newspaper editor, I was known for having relatively commercial interests. I knew how to sell a paper to a blue-collar audience. So I thought I could afford to work cheap for a while if I can get myself apprenticed to a studio president or a major independent producer, work as an assistant too for a couple of years. I may be able to learn enough in that period of time to be able to do something myself, produce. So I went to Hollywood with that notion in mind and spent a couple of months just kind of talking to anybody who would talk to me, and learned that the job that I envisioned for myself didn't exist, and that if it did exist, that any kid from USC Film School was more qualified for it than I was, but had gotten then interested in film, and it came clear that if I was going to do anything in the film industry, that it would only be writing, that was the only saleable skill that I had. So I bought a little book called How to Write a Screenplay and read some screenplays. Went.
Okay, well, a lot of people are doing this every year and have been doing so. Yep. So where was the difference with you? Persistence, raw talent, some luck, all of those, what?
I think all those things. I mean, there were a lot of it. If I told you, the story is too long to tell truly accurately. But if I did take the time to tell it to you really accurately, the thing that you would be struck by was, if ever I've heard a story about the right place at the right time and people meeting on street corners and mm-hmm. accidents, you know, that's what you would think. You would say, yeah, well, I see how that happened now. It was just kind of either fate, if you believe in fate, or luck, if you don't.
I'm beginning to think this is a consistency with you. You talked about Judith Thurman and was it Vince?
Yeah right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, how, when...
A writer named David Rayfield worked on it. Redford had ideas. Streep had ideas. You know, the collaboration level was high, but I don't remember it being... I mean, you can, you know, if I tell you we need a scene about such and such, you can think of what it is that people are going to say to each other.
Well, let's take a specific scene. When Redford and Streep are dancing at the New Year's Eve party, it is at that moment that we have the clearest expression of, look, this is their country, their traditions, how do you presume to control them, educate right. them? So where did that decision... Take us through maybe that one scene. You had to choose that moment to bring all of those elements in.
I don't know how you make decisions like that. I can't take you through it. I mean, one of Karen's characteristics was a more than was healthy degree of possessiveness. And I wanted to play with the possessive pronouns. My land, my kikuyu, my, there's a lot to own, isn't there? So you just,
okay.
When you started with the character way back when, you say one of the things that you want to make a part of her is this need for her to grab things and put her stamp on everything. And you want to do it in speech, so.
A theme of freedom.
Correct. When you say, yeah, that it feels like an 80s kind of thing. But again, I mean, it actually begins with Dennis and Karen. I mean, the situation that you're looking at there is, well, we've got a love story. And Dennis loved Karen. And God knows Karen loved Dennis. So why didn't they get together? Well, what's the problem here? And you have to work through. Dennis cared more about obligation, about his own freedom.
I'm curious about the parable of the stork in the book, which is a marvelous thing. Difficult to visualize, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. How do you do it without the... I thought about having her, you know, do with pebbles in the dirt, and thought, in screen time, it's going to take too long and deliver too little. And it's a parable that's a nice parable that should stay where it is as language in a book. But the,
so you were able to be ruthless about
it. Well, yeah, you've got to be ruthless in the sense of using common sense. I mean, you can't just...
Well, I use that word intentionally
yeah.
because you do have to make some very, very difficult
yeah.
decisions there.
Why did she write in English?
Yeah.
Commercial reasons.
So it wasn't just...
Yeah, she had to write to support herself. And, you know, publishing in Danish was not going to provide the audience that she needed.
I think she wrote in English first.
Yeah.
Did they speak English mostly when they were in Africa? Or
mm-hmm.
was,
yeah.
Just because that was who was
yeah.
sort of in dominance there was the...
Yeah. Well, I mean, Karen, you know, she was... of the aristocracy in the sense of, you know, her family had money. She didn't have a title, but her family had money. So she knew English from the time she was small as a second language. Obviously, then when you get to a British colony where virtually everybody was the only European language that the natives knew, you know, nobody else, the only people who would have known Danish would have been she and Brohr. And Brohr's, of course, Brohr's first language is Swedish. So
they might as well speak.
Yeah.
She must have been awfully fluent in it to be able to write like that.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that's distinctive about her, it's because it's a second language, I'm sure. She is such a beautiful grammarian. I mean, her grammar is just flawless. And it's because she learned by rote the rules of a second language.
Yeah.
this is about absence of malice, and I'm a little bit off the track, so...
Because here's a woman who wanted more than she could possibly have or should have had, and lost everything, and survived with a dignity that became controlling. I mean, her personal dignity is such that she doesn't just survive, she prevails. I want them to think, you know, boy, Karen Blixen was one hell of a woman.